A Map of the World, Disc 9.
The weeks passed. I had lain in bed on the night of the 4th and listened to the firecrackers going off in the subdivisions. Our independence didn't seem like much of a victory. There was a storm one morning at the end of July. I went out on the porch and watched the rain come down. According to the gauge, there were 6/10 of an inch. Around noon, the sun came out. The steam rose from the damp earth, and by evening the soil was dry. The soybeans grew fairly well with my attention and the irrigation. All the sheep were dead. The cows lay under the oaks in their pasture in the heat of the day and chewed their cuds. Teresa used to say that the animals were blessed because they did not have the capacity to know or plan or remember. They didn't seem blissful as they chewed. They endured endless passing hours. They endured the daylight and the dark of night. Their blessing was probably wasted on them, as I suppose so many of our blessings are wasted on us. The last night Teresa came down wasn't much different from any of the other nights that had come before, except that we had the previous accumulated nights and days behind us. Although she seemed unflagging, she must have been worn out after those 3 weeks. She had told me earlier, at lunch, that Dan was in Chicago for the weekend, at a convention of museum directors. We had laughed at the image of him at a black-tie banquet in the main hall of the Field Museum, having cocktails with the presidents of the Smithsonian and the American Museum of Natural History. We said we were sure that he, too, was laughing at himself, honorably representing the Derry Shrine. I had said again at lunch that I hadn't seen Dan in well over a month. "He's working all the time, spinning his wheels," Teresa had said under her breath. I was in the kitchen that evening when she brought the girls home. Emma came running to the porch. She shouted from outside, "Can Audrey stay over?" Teresa opened the door and set the bag lunch down on the kitchen table. Before Teresa could say no, I said, "That's fine with me." I'm not sure what I was thinking or if I had even heard the request. The girls wrung each other's hands. Audrey alternately clasped Teresa around the waist and jumped to her shoulders, beseeching her to say yes. I realized too late that Teresa could not allow her only daughter to stay in our house. The idea was absurd. We both spoke at once. "I would miss you too much, Audrey," Teresa said. I was saying that it probably wasn't a good night for it, after all. She and I turned to each other as we were talking. I think we understood what had gone through the other's mind. "Wait," Teresa said. "Settle down." She put her hands on Audrey's shoulders and made her keep still. "You girls get ready for bed and play in Emma's room while Howard has his dinner. Then we'll go home. Audrey can stay some other time. We'll plan it. No, no complaining. You've got your chance to stay for a while." Everyone seemed to think, with very little protesting, that it was a tolerable compromise. We went upstairs. Emma first, and then Audrey and Teresa. Claire and I brought up the rear. There were baskets of laundry in the bedroom. I was afraid she might offer to take the dirty clothes home. She passed by and looked in without saying anything. As they got ready, there was chipping and chattering. They made the house sound like a menagerie. There was peace in the commotion. I helped Claire into her pajamas and brushed her teeth. I put my clarinet together and stood in the doorway of Emma's room with a reed in my mouth, watching my neighbor brush my daughter's hair. "How do you get a comb through your curls?" Emma asked Teresa. "Well," Teresa said, "I shampoo every morning. When it's wet, I quick brush it. All I have to do is let it dry, and it comes out like this. If I brush it or comb it when it's dry, it gets frizzy. It sticks out. It's big and awful." She bit her lip as she smiled at me over the top of Emma's head. "Really?" Emma turned to me to check if what Teresa had said could be true. My daughter's hair and simple body were made of straight lines. I'd never given much consideration to our friend's thick, loopy curls, but I could see how they might be interesting to someone who had been bald for the first 2 years of her life.
"Do a song for us, Daddy," Claire shouted.
"I think I've forgotten," I said. I hadn't practiced in several weeks. I was going to sound rusty. While I put the reed in place, I thought through my repertoire.
"I didn't know you played,"
Teresa said. I don't, really, I said. I just, Sing me a happy song, Claire cried. That's my favorite. We can work it out, Emma demanded. Or morning has broken. My dad, she says to Audrey, he knows all the songs. I played badly. Teresa continued to brush Emma's hair. The three girls sat politely and listened. When I was done, Teresa tucked them in the same bed. Good night, they called. We paused at the door. Good night, we said. We went downstairs, the two of us. We could hear them plotting their riot. Teresa said she didn't think they'd last long, that they were tired. I looked through the bare cupboards, trying to find something to offer her. There was milk in the refrigerator. I'm fine, she said. You eat. She fed her family skim milk, not our whole milk, with the cream sitting in a lump on the top. She always insisted it was milk to bathe in, not to drink. Go ahead, she said, gesturing for me to sit at my own table in front of the sack she had brought. She opened the cupboard, reached up for a glass, went to the sink, and poured herself some water. I looked in the bag. There were two bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwiches. The toasted wheat bread was saturated with what was undoubtedly low-fat mayonnaise. There was a bunch of grapes, carrot sticks, cold-cooked beans in a baggie, and three chocolate chip cookies. I didn't know what to call Teresa anymore. What should I say to her, this person who didn't fit in any category I knew of? Friend, I suppose she was, although I'd never had a friend before who had gone to such lengths. I should say thank you. That hardly seemed enough. I don't know what I'd do without you, while True was going too far. You are good to me was corny. It was awkward all of a sudden. In the amount of time it took me to look in the bag, I no longer knew what to say. I should say something. Here I was, so hungry, eating her food, food that she'd made expressly for me. She had drunk some of her water and was looking slantwise at an ant slugging along the linoleum with a crumb. That was nice for Emma and Claire, upstairs, putting them to bed. I cleared my throat. This is awfully good. She nodded, keeping her eyes on the ant. She kept watching it while I bolted her sandwiches. I couldn't think what we had talked about over so many lunches. I half wanted to get away. Thank you for making this, I choked. It was with some difficulty that she tore herself from the ant and turned her gaze on me. There was a whole wad of bread in my mouth, bulging in my cheek. I stopped chewing. I don't know how it happens that two people can find themselves lost in an ordinary kitchen. The old clock, the hum of the refrigerator, the fan going in the living room, nothing was making noise anymore. The table, the cluttered countertop, the full compost bucket by the sink, the chatter from upstairs, everything fell away. We were caught in an empty place. It was just the two of us, shining at each other. It wasn't until she shook her curls, put her hands to her face, that we looked away. She was breathless and flushed as if she'd run a long distance right to our table. I stared up, chewing. It's just a mess, she wheezed. Alice felt responsible for Lizzie. My friend Albert talked to me about, what did he call it? The quality of mercy. The quality of mercy. He talked about how mercy blesses the giver and the receiver. The way he said it was beautiful. I've tried hard to think how Alice must feel. I wouldn't want to trade places with her, not for a minute. She'll always feel responsible, won't she? Nothing we can say will make her think she shouldn't have done something different. I say that to myself, the quality of mercy, when I'm despairing. I say those words as if I'm doing the rosary, and I know, Howard, I know that embracing your family will bless me. She was trying to catch her breath and talk all at once. What am I saying? Of course I'd change places if it meant Lizzie would be alive, but do you see what I mean? It would be so convenient to use Alice as a great big depository, the Alice did it dump. That's tempting, very tempting. My sisters have fallen into the trap, but I'm not going to, Howard. I'm not going to. They say that Alice deserves to be locked up. If I disagree, they give each other knowing looks, a we-know-Teresa's-sick-in-the-head look. I made the mistake of telling one of them that I feel responsible for Alice. I think they were about ready to commit me. But I do feel responsible for her because I could have prevented the charge, because Lizzie's death gave Carol Mackesy the spark she needed. You feel beholden to me for the food and the babysitting. I can't stand it. Could we please stop seeing it in these terms? We belong together. That's how I think of it. Your girls are helping Audrey. They're helping me get through the day. Sure, it would be nice if Dan could wake up, if he could step out of himself long enough to realize that Alice is actually in jail because the community is going through a purging ritual. I just feel, well, mute half the time. Dan will drop over dead working before he figures out that the way through grief is grief itself. He's fighting it with all his strength because he thinks it will kill him. I was eating as fast as I could, tearing the grapes off their stems. I should tell her that she was more than adequately helping me get through hour after hour. Going up to her house was on a par with climbing out of the pit of hell. The time in her kitchen was what I looked forward to every day. I sat on the chaise up there just so I could hear her sing. And I looked forward to her coming down at night, too, seeing her for just a minute when she brought the girls home. The need was both startling and obvious. It was something I guess I should have known. The need I had for her, for Teresa Collins, was so clear I couldn't see straight. "They're quiet up there," she said. "They played so hard today, I guess I'm not surprised. Let me go make sure they're okay." She moved across the room to the stairs. I had forgotten what it was like to be drawn to a person. I didn't know how I could have stood in the doorway day after day looking at Teresa without actually seeing her as I was now. I'd forgotten how your blood flows toward a person when they move, so that all at once you know what the pull of gravity feels like, and you know that this is something strong and important, something that you need for life, this woman moving through the room. When she came back down, I was at the sink, waiting. "I don't want to leave her," she murmured. She stood across the table from me. "You know that." "Stay a little longer," I said. "I'll carry her up the hill. I'll carry her home in a minute." I mentioned that it was cooler out on the porch and that there was a moon. "I don't care about the moon," she said. "Come out on the porch." I could feel her behind me as I went, feel my blood drawn to my back. "I need to go home," she whispered. We stood in the middle of the dark porch, on the rag rug that Alice has always especially liked. "Sometimes," Teresa said, "I'm certain about the goodness of God. Sometimes I'm sure that Lizzie is in safekeeping. But tonight I'm really scared, Howard. Tonight everything feels as if it's tipping. Tonight," she said, coming closer, "it's so confusing. Everything feels dangerous because of you. And at the same time, everything feels dangerous except right where you are." She flew into my outstretched arms, hit hard, and stayed there. That is how I remember it. I meant to draw her in, and she was already against me. "They put her in the ground," she cried into my chest. "It was hot, that yellow, windy night she was buried. It was blowing, blowing. I couldn't stop them from burying her. I couldn't stop it." We held each other, swaying back and forth. She was so heavy, too heavy to hold up. We sank to the hard porch floor, nothing between us and the stone but the thin rug woven from old jeans and shirts. We held each other against each fresh, racking sob as it came. Chapter 14. I learned early enough, when I was 6, that the world is a sorrowful place. Our neighbor, Peter Nichols, was messing around on the tracks a few blocks from home. He got electrocuted by the third rail. With the windows open that summer, I occasionally heard his mother. She made an exhausting noise. I thought she was singing up and down the scale, even though I knew what she was doing had no relation to music. It scared me for years after that the boy had been alive 1 minute and was dead the next. It was unacceptable. How was it that he couldn't take back a 1 second mistake? After all this time, it still seems impossible that a person can be killed instantly without knowing. I tried to say to Teresa the night she came down that I had not yet been able to get beyond the shock of Lizzie's death. I didn't know that she was gone unless I thought hard about it. "I don't understand," was what I managed to say. We lay on the rug for a good part of the night. We held on to each other. We had to thrash with the sadness. It was inside us, beating inside us. We couldn't hold still. When we thought we were at last done, we'd slowly work up to begin again. It was a cycle that didn't seem to have an end. At one point, Teresa cried, "I don't think we're ever going to finish, that we'll ever get to the bottom of this great fathomless reservoir." I couldn't see past the moment either. I didn't know how we'd be able to stand up, dust ourselves off, go home. Every now and then, in a sudden calm, she lifted her head and spoke. Early on, she said, "When I account for my children, like a mother duck, I think Audrey is in the den, Lizzie is in the ground. How many times do I have to say Lizzie is dead before I'll know it? How many times? When people ask me how many children I have, I need to say two, because I still have two, don't I? I always sound flustered, and the people get mixed up and embarrassed. 'Oh, but one is dead,' they'll finally figure. 'But I still have two children. Lizzie is still my child.'" She lay back against me, and it continued, the rolling and thrashing and sobbing. "It feels like we're only the husk for some wild thing tearing around inside us," she wailed. In another lull, she said, "Wouldn't it be handy if you could take your eyeballs out? Let them get on with the long, tiresome work of crying." We had laughed a little before our losses brought us down. "What am I going to do, Howard?" She kept asking that same question again and again. I said I didn't know. I can't say how long we wept and then how long we lay quietly. I knew that time was passing only because the moon kept rising. We lay on the floor, sniffling. She was awfully heavy in the crook of my arm. I could feel her eyelashes on my neck and her breath through my shirt. I was afraid to move, afraid the slightest change might make her go away. When the moon passed over the windmill, she hoisted herself up and looked into my face. Where her glasses had gone, I can't say. "Sometimes I just want to die," she said in that soft way under her breath. "I just want to die so I can go where Lizzie is. Sometimes it seems a punishment, as if I'm trapped on Earth." I pulled her back down and kissed her dark hair. "No," I said, "it's all right here." I hated to think that she wanted to die. Everything about Teresa radiated goodness. A person could understand her uncomplicated sorrows. I could feel her relaxing again into my chest. We would get up in a minute. I would turn on the glaring porch light and we'd resume our life. We were tired and finally insensible. I could hardly lift my head. We must have both slept for a while. Perhaps she also thought she'd break away in the next minute and the next. And like counting sheep, the exercise put her to sleep. It felt good to sleep. For the first time in what felt like months, I slept soundly. Her skin smelled so fine as I drifted off. I don't think I dreamed about anything but her strange, foreign smell. In my memory, when I go back to that night, the clock does not tick. The only thing that moves is the night sky. On the porch, that means nothing to us. We were leaden, spellbound, like Shakespearean lovers who have drunk a potion. When she woke, sitting up in alarm, I turned and pulled her back to me. That action surprised me as much as anything. I knew her movements in my sleep. That I was lying on the floor in the middle of the night with my wife's friend, my neighbor's wife, my children's playfellow's mother did not seem to matter. "I need to go home, Howard," she said into my shirt. "Stay." "I can't," she whispered. She hovered over me, stroking my cheek with her knuckles. I didn't want to wake up. I unfolded her hand and brought it to my lips. She let me. She smiled as if it was an indulgence, allowing me to kiss each finger one by one. I made a point to smell her skin as I kissed. It came to me that hers was the fragrance of an early spring morning. It wasn't the efforts of a genius soap manufacturer. It seemed to me that it was her own scent, that smell of fresh, loamy earth and light. "You smell nice," I uttered. "You smell like spring dirt." She laughed out loud and then quickly put her small hand to her mouth. "Coming from you, I take that as a compliment." She shook her head. "Dirt." She leaned down. I thought she was going to kiss my forehead. "Dirt," she said again. "I love that." We may both have thought of Alice. Teresa may have considered for an instant that she would have to tell Alice what I had said, that it bore repeating. I thought how Alice often accused me of calculating milk price supports when I was making love to her. She was far away and seemed inconsequential. I dismissed her. "Please don't tell me what I smell like," I said. "Rain," she murmured. "How about that? You smell like rain." "Ah, rain." She traced over my eyebrows and eyelids, down along my jaw, brushing slowly over my mouth. I watched her. She outlined my lips with one finger before she came away. The night seemed as if it would go on indefinitely, if only she would again rest against my chest. We would talk of dirt and rain. It was she who held the charm, who could make not only the clock but also the moon stop. I don't know if she was weighing the importance of the night against real life. I wanted her to touch me, to keep stroking my face. I shut my eyes and I could still feel her next to me. Her smell was more intense without sight. "Howard," she said finally. I knew there wasn't much time left. I pulled up slowly. I put her loopy curls behind her ears. "How do you get a comb through this hair?" I asked. She laughed with abandon, without stifling her pleasure. I held her face, and she smiled in that hopelessly breathless way. I guess I knew there would only be that one instant to kiss her. I hesitated, seeing the night in the distance, already a memory. The desire I felt for her could only always be seen as good. She was beautiful and wise, her voice and song, her face and laugh a salve. "Teresa," I breathed into that kiss. I held on as long as I could, moving inside her mouth, all brightness, tongue to tongue. Her eyelashes fluttered like a small animal's heartbeat against my cheek. When she pulled away, I followed her mouth. "That's all," she whispered, gently pushing me off. We bent our heads together, knowing full well the reason for stopping. I helped her to her feet, and then she let go. She nodded. That was the signal. I went to get Audrey. I walked up each stair, one by one. The night vanished quickly behind me. I considered as I moved, going down, returning to the porch to see if that pocket of time and space was still there. The girls were sprawled all over each other, arms and legs in a tangle, They were damp, heavy. None of them woke as I moved them around. Audrey chewed and groaned. She had curly hair like her mother's. She was warm in my arms. I couldn't help looking at her, also seeing her in a way I hadn't before. I held her carefully, this child, Teresa's child. I made my way slowly down the hall, telling her that I was taking her home. Teresa was already outside on the lawn, shifting from left to right foot, back and forth, the way a person does in winter. She was holding herself around the waist. She found her glasses. The nearly full moon, waning now beyond the chicken shed, made the world seem cool. She ran between the rows of dead corn, and I followed, unable to keep up with her. When we got to the edge of the property, I handed Audrey over. She didn't need to tell me not to come farther. I watched her trudge with her load along Mrs. Klinky's hedgerow. When a dog barked up the street, I went down on all fours, expecting the lights to come on in the houses. The people would stream into their backyards, looking for the trouble. When I opened my eyes the next morning, I was in my own bed. Alice's clock said 3:30. The sun was shining on the ceiling in long, pale rectangles. It took me a minute to realize that the clock must have run down long before. I imagined Alice looking through the walls of the jail, through the metal windows, across the waking city, over the fields, to our bed, to me. I imagined her wistful smile and her voice, her sarcastic, "What are you going to have for lunch today? I know you like that fruit salad." I could tell by the slant of the sun that I was already an hour late for milking, and still I lay looking at the ceiling. I remembered the night before with absolute calm what both Alice and Teresa had remarked was my strength. Teresa and I had wept until we were finished. I had held her, wondering if it was true that a sorrow like hers, like ours, could eventually fade. I think I hoped that it wouldn't. I hoped that we would always be able to walk onto the porch, just the two of us, when everyone else was conveniently absent. I hoped that we would always be able to dip into that current of sadness. I suspect I knew then, lying in bed, that we could no longer wait, according to Rafferty's instructions. It is difficult to pinpoint exactly when our lives began to unravel. In a snap, I can trace the wrongdoing straight back to Alice. Like Teresa, I resist that temptation. I know it is not honest or fair to place all of the blame on my wife. That morning, I did not get right up. I lay thinking that years from now, if someone came across a chronicle of Alice's life, the summer of Lizzie's death would be the one period of time that stood out. She would be the great-great-grandmother who spent several months in jail, the ancestor who abused the boy. Future generations could blame their bad traits on her. It seemed cruel that her afterlife was already determined. If I was noted, it would be only in relation to Alice, her husband, perhaps being the faceless name next to the fleshed-out, ignominious great-great-grandmother is an even crueler fate. I lay under the sheet, watching the morning pass. I knew how much energy it was going to take to catch up with the work. It was then that I first said to myself, "I can't do it." I wasn't surprised when Teresa didn't come down on Saturday. It was late by the time I started chores. I was swabbing Maggie, an older cow who picked fights if she felt put upon, when Emma appeared in the aisle. The girls rarely came out in the morning, and she startled me. "What do you want?" I said. I must have been speaking in accusing tones because Maggie turned to look at me.
"I didn't do anything," Emma whined. "Why aren't you done yet, anyway?"
I stood slowly. My insides burned and ached as I inched to an upright posture. "Guess I'm tired," I said.
"Where's Teresa?"
Claire called from the doorway.
"When is Mama coming home?" Emma said, tugging at my shirt. "I forget when you said she was coming back."
My daughters were still wearing their pajamas. Emma's were so worn the print of the material was gone. You could see through to her skin. Alice might get convicted and spend years serving time. With all the skill Rafferty could muster, he might not be able to fight the boy in his three-piece suit and the abused doll that had had to endure atrocity, real and imagined, in court case after court case. I had abstractly considered the possibility that Alice might not get out of prison for years. I had not yet thought about what we would actually do if she was to be held captive for the better part of our lives. I was confused so early in the morning by what had happened in the night. It came to me as I stared at Emma's shabby pajamas that I thought I knew Teresa and that my knowledge was based on a feeling, not anything more reliable than a blind man indelicately pressing on a face with both hands to get a sense of its form. I had thought at one time that I knew Alice, but that knowledge also had proved to amount to nothing. She probably knew me more than I wanted to be known. I felt very tired. I didn't know if I had ever loved anything. I guess I couldn't have said what it meant to love someone. We had a life together. Alice was my wife. Those things suggested an illusion and implied love. I have since wondered if a person can know how deep a thing goes without getting outside of it, without taking it apart, without, in fact, ruining it. I could have one night with Teresa, more tender than any Alice and I might have together, and still Alice would exert herself. My wife would slip away. I would lose her, but she would still have a hold. The certainty of those things made me feel sick. I leaned over, thinking I might vomit into the gutter. I made my way down the aisle, going laboriously from cow to cow, the four milking units working at the same time. If Alice was convicted, we might live our lives on parallel tracks, she on the inside, the girls and I on the outside. We would visit at regular intervals. She might get to come to Emma's eighth grade graduation. She'd shuffle along in her manacles for the first outing of her prison life. The evening news would cover the touching story. I wondered then if Alice's present imperturbable state might not last her for the rest of her days. She might insist upon my release, calmly laying out for me our divorce, the name of my future wife, the training necessary for my new occupation. She might think I could leave her to be counted at the wake-up call day after day until she died of a prison epidemic. She might spend a good part of her time writing Emma and Claire, reminding them of that dog caught on its leash, wound around the tree. The dog was the one thing I managed to save.
"Daddy," Emma grumbled, "I said, when is Mom coming home? You aren't even listening to me."
"September," I said, "October."
"How many minutes?"
I did a quick calculation. If she got out in 6 weeks in the middle of September, which certainly wasn't going to happen, but if she did, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 43,000 minutes. That sounded manageable. 43,000, I said.
"Oh."
She was satisfied. She stooped down to pet a kitten she'd tamed.
"Do you think cats know how they look?"
she asked. The scruffy white one in her hands had a black nose, one black eye, and a black circle on its back. "No," I said.
"I wouldn't want her to know she's ugly."
If I'd been in the mood, it would have been time for an allegory. I kept moving down the aisle. My father used to tell me the story of my great-grandfather solely as a scare tactic. I was the only child, and worse yet, a son. My father had to tell me what could go wrong in life so that I stood a better chance of avoiding the pitfalls. There was no reason for me to repeat anyone else's mistakes. He was determined I make something of myself. The great-grandfather seems to have had a nervous breakdown after his third wife discovered she was pregnant with his ninth child. The two other wives had both died during or shortly after pregnancy. The grandfather took sick, is how the lesson came down to me. My great-grandmother supported the family by taking in laundry. Months later, long after the baby was safely delivered, the old boy came to his senses. When he fully understood what he had done to his family, how he had humiliated them and abandoned them, he died on the spot. So the story goes. I think my father needed to tell me about him, not because it was family history, but because it taught the horror of shame, the goodness of duty. I interrupted my rhythm of washing the udders and slipping on the milking units to watch the girls climbing barefoot on the hay bales in the corner. I didn't know how they could stand the sharp tufts on their feet. The cows swished their tails and stamped. There's a Bible verse my mother always used to say, "In the day of prosperity there is a forgetfulness of affliction, and in the day of affliction there is no more remembrance of prosperity." She used to say things like that when I was going about my ordinary business. Memory does not serve a person well, is what I got out of that one. Not 12 hours had passed, and my memory of the night before was changing. It was dispiriting to think that something that had seemed good was going to go through several revolutions in my mind. The girls, already dirty so soon in the morning, had come to the barn to remind me that nothing is ever simple. I could insist to myself that the evening was one thing, two people responding to sadness. That's how I aim to remember it. I also imagine that Teresa and I are each other's best secret. Both of us probably think back to that night when we are in need of consolation and the idea of love. On the porch, with the moon climbing ever higher, I had thought that I loved her, and that there couldn't be anything wrong with loving her. In the morning light, I knew that it was treachery to think so. We spent that Saturday at the pond. I sat in the shade with a hat pulled over my eyes while the girls paddled around in their life jackets. We had not gone down the lane since Lizzie's death. It was hot. Always hot, and everywhere we sat or stood felt like a blistering sidewalk. "Can't we at least swim?" Emma had pleaded. Swimming or not swimming wasn't going to bring Lizzie back, I said to myself. The girls had stood on the bank, looking out to the water, remembering, I think, that the pond was dangerous. Gradually, they let the small waves lure them to the edge. It wasn't long before they forgot Lizzie had been taken there. I didn't recall until the next day that there would be no one to leave the girls with for my Sunday visit to the jail. I had promised Alice I would never bring them along with me. I thought for less than a second of calling Miss Bowman. I stood by the phone in the kitchen for quite some time, putting my hand down on the phone, taking it off again. It seemed reasonable to call Teresa until I was touching the receiver. "Just pick it up," I said to myself. "No," I responded, "I can't." I paced back and forth across the kitchen. I had promised Alice I would never bring the children to visit. But first, I argued, there was no one who would take the girls. I would tell Alice that Teresa was regrettably busy or away. I would tell her that they had stayed with Miss Bowman in June, and then she would understand my difficulties. Second, it was true that after well over a month on my own, I knew our situation better even than Alice. Emma and Claire needed to see her, to know that she was still herself. She always asked so urgently about them. She had a hunger for them, strong enough, it seemed, to propel her through the plexiglass. She needed to see them, too. I didn't come near to admitting to myself that the girls would serve a purpose, that they would deflect attention. They would shield me from Alice's keen eyes. That Sunday morning, I convinced myself that what she wanted all along was to see Emma and Claire through the filthy window. It would perk her up to hear their voices through the static of the phone line. Over one of the many bowls of cold cereal we ate in Alice's absence, I said, "Let's take a drive this afternoon. Let's take baths and put on clean clothes and go cheer Mom up." Emma was about to take a bite, but she lowered her spoon, set it back into her bowl.
"You mean we can visit her?"
"We can visit her," I answered. You mean we're allowed? It's not a nice place, Emma, I said. I think you already know that. You remember, we won't be able to be in the same room with her. There's glass in between. But I think it would make Mom happy to see you. We bathed. They dug in their closets and found clean sundresses. Although Alice would not be in a position to inspect their ears, I gouged the wax out all the same. Teresa had given them haircuts recently, so they did not look like street children. Claire wriggled with excitement. Emma bounced on the bed. I tried to clip their nails, but they couldn't keep still. When I let them go, they ran out the door. They went skipping in the dry grass, running back and forth, shouting in a sing-song chant, "We're going to see Mama! We're going to see Mama!" For the second time that morning, I knelt to retch. At the jail, the girls clung to me as we passed through the metal detector. They were terrified by the doors buzzing and the crush of the visitors in the narrow corridor. We sat on the stool at the second station, waiting for Alice to emerge. I had never had to wait much before, but that afternoon there was a delay. We sat, waiting, thinking she was going to come through on her side any minute. No one was let out. The girls were fighting over how they were sitting on my lap. Claire insisted that Emma had more of my body than she did. I spread my legs and put one child on each so that the territories were clearly fair. Once that was straightened out, they began to argue over who was going to talk first. Emma lay out an elaborate plan. Each of us were to have 3 minutes, then 2 minutes, and then 1 minute. We'd start the cycle over and over until our time was up. Emma, just because, was going to begin. When they began swatting each other, I sent them to look through the large glass window at our backs at what I believe is called the communication room. There are several computers, switchboards with blinking lights, and two deputies wearing headsets. Alice was the second out. She wasn't to her station when she saw them. I stood up, both trying to get a better look at her and trying to block her view. She was wearing a pink bandana around her head. It was tied up tight in a way that made her look as if she didn't have any hair. She had a bruise on her forehead, a large purple and black and green circle like a third eye. She had a panicked, hunted look in her two eyes. I turned to find the girls, trying to think how to keep them from seeing her. They were still watching the operators. I reached for the phone to say something, anything. She pressed against the glass as if she'd forgotten that it separated us. But even as I was yelling, "Pick up the phone," she was backing away, making for the guard. The girls were at my side then, trying to see over the dividers. I thought for a second that she was going to fight the guard, but the minute he touched her, she sank into his arms. She was limp, even as he pushed her off. He was shouting at her to stand up, to get moving. She kept sinking back into him. He finally had the sense to put his arm around her and let her out the door. He shook his head. He kept shaking his head, as if to say, "Not another crazy one." Chapter 15. The first time I thought we'd have to leave the farm might well have been the day at the beginning when I called around trying to find a sitter for the girls. I had called Susanna Brooks and Kathy Johnson to ask them to take the children while I went to visit Alice. I remember standing with a phone in my hand, watching Emma and Claire run through the sprinkler. They didn't know yet that they were blackballed. They were skipping like they had nothing to worry about. Emma figured she'd wear twirling skirts to school in the fall and drink milk out of pint cartons. Kindergarten, in her book, was in the neighborhood of heaven. I guess I'd known as I watched both of them dancing in the spray that we couldn't stay in Prairie Center. Still, it would be a lie to say I had seriously thought of selling the farm before that last night Teresa came down. I hadn't known before just how easy it is to lie. I hadn't known either what it costs. We got out of the visiting room at the jail as fast as we could on Sunday. The girls had at the most only seen Alice's form, almost a shadow it was. She can't come down today, I said, as we tore along the corridor to the outside.
Why not? Why not?
Emma cried, running along to catch up with me. She's sick, I said. Emma stopped by the locker where we had had to stash the car keys.
She is not sick!
The veins in her slender neck bulged when she screamed.
You made that up! She just didn't want to see you!
I slammed the locker shut. The door buzzed and I got out. I walked down the block to the car without hearing the girls screech after me. There was glass, a condom on the walk, scraps of styrofoam in the gutter, paper twisted into the metal of the chain-link fence.
You're lying!
Emma shrilled at my back. After we settled in the car, I suggested we go find a beach, that we take a look at Lake Michigan. The name comes from an Ojibwa word that means it is a big lake. I said so to the girls. I could see Claire in the rearview mirror staring out the window. There were tears slipping down her cheeks. Emma had her head down and was crying to herself. What they were learning, what I was teaching them, was to grieve like adults. We'll find a beach, I said. We'll hunt for some good skipping stones.
Shut up,
Emma said to her lap. We did go to the lake, and we did gather stones. We found smooth gray and black and white stones. There was a large sign stuck in the sand that said in red letters, "Swimming prohibited by order of the health department." The beach was deserted. We walked, choosing stones and putting them in my cap. A few gulls screeched and flapped at us as we picked our way around the dead alewives. The sun was hot and the water looked hot, and the fish bones were baking and the stones in my cap grew heavier and heavier. On the way home, near the outskirts of Prairie Center, we saw something that you never see in small towns. There was an older man squatting by the highway. He was too close to the road, on the gravel shoulder. He didn't have anything on his head. Our corner of the state was a prosperous one. There weren't homeless people or poor minorities. There weren't rich minorities either. The guy was squinting into the sun. He was holding up a piece of cardboard that said, "I need food." We drove past him and went on home. The girls took a swim and I dunked in and out. I did the chores earlier than usual, and by 7:30, Emma and Claire were in bed. Emma had been giving me the cold, silent treatment, as so many of her sex have done before her. After they were asleep, I sat at the kitchen table to write a letter to Alice to explain. I must already have known that I would try to sell the farm. Rafferty would be furious. He had often seemed to relish the fact that we had so much property, the one thing that should prove to the judge the quality of our citizenship. He used the words synonymously, upstanding, moral, hardworking, 400 acres, 60 head of cattle. Our holdings were none of his business. Our life had come apart swiftly in June. We had waited through July and now into August. It had taken time to understand that the damage was irreparable. I knew that the girls couldn't go to school at Blackwell Elementary. I knew that I couldn't farm without a wife, that there wasn't any point in farming without a family. I also couldn't picture living down the road from Vermont Acres year after year. I'd have to sit in our living room reading the paper after lunch, knowing that up the way Teresa was singing in her kitchen. "Dear Alice," I finally wrote, "I think I'd be a good used car salesman. Maybe in the next life. I've lost all of what you used to imagine were my redeeming qualities. Emma called me a liar this afternoon. I am no longer calm or moderate, and despite the tone of this letter, I'm not nearly so sentimental. I am worried about you. I'm sorry about bringing the girls. It was a mistake. Claire and Emma have learned to cry like adults. They sit by themselves and cry without making much noise. We need you with us for plenty of reasons, but not least to gently help the girls shake off a few years so they can again have a tantrum. What a relief that will be. Howard. That was the best I could do. It took me nearly 2 hours to write so little. When I was finished, I went out to the mailbox and slipped the envelope and the long silver insides. I wondered if the man was still out on the road. It was the simplicity of the sign that made it effective. I need food. When my time came, what would my sign say, I wondered? I need work? Jokes? Family? Love? When I came back to the house, I set the stones from the beach one by one in a glass pie plate. Those were our stones to put up in the attic, our small, heavy pile for remembrance. On Monday morning after chores, I called Davis Realty in faraway Waukesha. I told the receptionist that I wanted to list the farm with them, that I would like to get the wheels turning as fast as possible. There were cicadas droning away in the trees, the first I'd noticed. They should have been singing for a couple of weeks. The whole place looked different. It looked like it didn't belong to me anymore. Maybe the farm had slowly become unfamiliar, starting to change on the day Alice left, and by now, at this late date, it was finally unrecognizable. She had had a kind of fit that night before she was arrested. She had lost her mind while I made love to her. It was very probable she'd done it. I don't think I would have thought her guilty if dozens of children had come forward with far-fetched stories. She had always spoken of Robbie with an anger that seemed beyond reason. She wouldn't hurt people in mass quantities, but one, she could have hurt just one. It was possible. I didn't have to voice those thoughts to be certain about the farm. There was no point in having it anymore. Shortly after 2 o'clock on Monday afternoon, Sandy Brickman from Davis Realty got out of her dented Maverick. She tottered up the gravel driveway in her high heels. I had seen her scowling as she removed her keys from the ignition. She tried not to show her disdain for the house, which was visibly tilting to the south, and the outbuildings, which long ago should have been burned to the ground. We had no grapevine wreaths stuck with dried flowers in our door. There were no lawn ornaments, no little black sambos in cast iron in our burned-out stubble. The place might have looked habitable if the grass hadn't been white. It might have seemed a find if the shutters in the front weren't hanging from one hinge, if the paint hadn't chipped off and fallen like snow to the ground. Our home suggested ruin. Sandy Brickman, with her real estate radar, knew it before she'd even set foot on the gravel drive. She had too much lipstick smeared on her mouth. She had bad skin, the pockmarked, greasy variety that reminded me of the girls in high school who used to give themselves away to any willing customer. Out of all the surreal characters in our dream summer, Sandy Brickman took the cake. She was incongruent in our landscape, as if she'd been set on our driveway as a gag. She stretched her hand out well before she was within 7 feet of me. I called to her. I knew I didn't want to get too close. "If we walk up to the plateau, we can get an overview," I said. She clasped my hand. She was sweating inside her pink suit. She looked directly into my eyes, as if she had a method of measuring what I would settle for. Her rings dug into my skin, and no doubt we exchanged something communicable in that shake. She thought that might be a good idea to start off with the big picture. "The house, well..." she snorted. My urchin children, who hadn't had their hair combed or a decent lunch, not to mention breakfast, trailed behind us.
"We didn't see our mom yesterday," Claire said, running up ahead and then facing Sandy and walking backwards.
"That's too bad," Sandy said.
I had made a point of calling a realtor in a distant city. Our pot boiler was localized and had not, as far as I knew, been heralded more than once on the news at the beginning. There was a fair chance Sandy knew nothing of our misfortunes. She would jump to her own conclusions. She might think that I was the ex-husband who had kidnapped his children. She might take a more kindly view, might assume that my wife had died in a crash, that we had gone to a séance to try to make contact. Sandy Brickman and I talked zoning. We talked arable land. We talked mound systems and septic systems and sewer. We talked county planning and town ordinances. Another one of my mother's famous sayings that has stuck is this one. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. I had the terrific urge to take Sandy by the shoulders and yell in her face. I'll be honest with you, I said quietly. My twin sister is dying of leukemia. None of us have insurance. We've been trying to raise funds for bone marrow treatment by having dances and collection cups in the supermarkets. I'm sure you can imagine what kind of money we're talking.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Sandy said.
Selling this place is a shot in the dark, I realize, but it's all I have left now for cash. I had wanted to spend my life caring for land, being a steward and raising food. When we moved in and I walked down to the barn for the first time, I couldn't imagine needing anything more. I had my own barn, a wife, a child. The barn had stanchions, a haymow, a milk house. It had stalls down below for sheep, a horse if we wanted. Alice once said that most men must secretly want a barn, even city-dwelling men. She saw how I was about the barn, how at night I'd make excuses to go out one more time. I need the cash, I said again. I wasn't sure there was anything in me that went deeper than my stinging skin. I wasn't sure I'd ever felt much more than an animal sensation, a veering toward ruin. Everywhere I looked, I kept seeing that sign. I need food. I can tell already that it's a real special piece of property, Sandy said as we walked along the edge of the soybean field. It was a respectable stand and the only green thing close to the ground. She was probably seeing the place divided up into 5-acre lots with dream houses, sprawling brick affairs with hardwood floors and decks, windows and views, stone fireplaces, master bedrooms with walk-in closets and jacuzzis, family rooms, great rooms, mud rooms, closets, closets, closets. It's going to take that special buyer. Now, you say that this property... parts of it, anyway, cannot be zoned residential. Is that right? Is it locked into some kind of conservation easement? She was huffing and puffing as we climbed the slope to the plateau. I just gotta get back into aerobics, she muttered. She kicked the ground and the earth rose in a puff of smoke. Is it dry or what? When she'd had a chance to catch her breath and scan the horizon, she pursed her lips as if to whistle. She blew out a silent stream of air as she shook her head. It is a good place. With your back to the east, you hardly notice the Greyhound racetrack in the distance. You can see the fields laid out in squares, the pond sparkling in the sunlight, and the old orchard beyond. You can see the cows standing still around the few shade trees in their worn pasture. You can see how far the woods stretch. You can see the marsh with its cattails and the cranes lifting off into the air, making their guttural trill. There's a marsh, a bog, and a fen on this property, I said, which was stretching the definitions of those wet places slightly. We definitely had a marsh and pretty much had a bog. The fen was questionable. No kidding, she said. I didn't know there were so many things like that. The bog is what had sold me on the place originally, a farm with a barn and a bog. This is a real special piece of property you've got here, she said for about the third time. I'll tell you what. She was going to deliver a secret, a Sandy Brickman kind of secret. She put the stem of her sunglasses into her mouth. They hung from her lips like some gruesome piece of orthodontia. "Yes," I said, waiting for the revelation.
"We'll have to have the house appraised, do a survey, work up the papers, take care of the business. I'm going to zip back to the office and make a few phone calls."
She managed to say that with her mouth full. "I'd really like to get this going," I said. She put her glasses back on.
"I think I'm having an inspiration, Guy."
She called me Guy as if it was my name and only I hadn't known it.
"What you have to do is sit tight. That's all you have to do."
Sandy Brickman, as it turned out, was the answer to the prayers somebody must have been making. Teresa was the only person I knew who prayed every day. It was more than likely that she was praying not only for her damned soul, but also for Alice and for me. I hold Teresa personally accountable for conjuring up Sandy Brickman. In the weeks that followed, the appraiser and the surveyor did their work. Even before Sandy wrestled with the details of our farm, the image of Mrs. Arnold L. Reisman must have risen up in her mind. Sandy had spent much of her professional life cultivating Mrs. Reisman. She must have somehow appealed to the lady not as an obsequious, money-grubbing real estate agent, but as a friend, an advocate, perhaps a lover of nature. It was mid-August when Sandy showed up. Alice had been in Racine for nearly 2 months. I remember Emma, around that time, wanting to go to the summer library story hour on Tuesday afternoon. She'd seen the banner across the windows advertising the event. I wouldn't let her. She went to her room and slammed the door like a teenager. Without Teresa, we were back to eating cornflakes for every meal. I had dreams that the old man and I were standing out on the road, both of us with our signs held high. I didn't let myself sit still to think. I didn't breathe a word of my plan out loud, even when I was alone in the presence of the barn walls. During the day, the girls put on their dress-up sunbonnets, and together we hauled stones. They didn't like it much, but they didn't have a choice. They'd get tired and play under the wagon. I cleared about 40 acres of stones last summer. One day, in Alice's stead, I made sauce from the early apples. I had to cut around the bad spots in every single wormy apple. There wasn't any sugar in the house, and when the girls tried a spoonful of the hot sauce, they acted as if I'd poisoned them. Right after the sign went up, Mrs. Reisman came to look at the farm. Sandy, Mrs. Reisman, and Arnold Reisman III arrived in a silver Volvo on a Wednesday morning. The sight of that car almost brought me to my knees. I have never really had a hankering for cars, but that silver automobile, so sturdily made, accident-proof, with the soft black leather seats, was a thing of incomparable beauty. Sandy got out first. She had not learned during the first round that high heels are unnecessary and also perilous when showing country property. Mrs. Reisman followed. She was a small woman, fine-boned, with short white hair and a lip that I guess was naturally swollen. It was an enormous upper lip. She was the same vintage as my mother, but she was rich, and as a result she seemed less concerned with appearance. She was wearing an embroidered shirt that had come from a poor Latin American country, and ordinary white kids yellowed with age. She had the deportment of a queen. I learned that her late husband, Arnold L. Reisman II, had been the scoutmaster for 35 years of Troop 19. She was looking for a plot of land to donate to the Boy Scouts of America, the Arnold L. Reisman II Scout Camp. Reisman, the boys would call it. We stood by the barn, getting our bearings. I handed the county topographical maps to Arnold III, and I held out the aerial view photograph for Mrs. Reisman. As I watched mother and son pore over the documents, I felt that I was beginning to see the world through Alice's eyes. She prided herself on her snap judgments. She had always seemed to think that sizing up people was a special talent. It didn't seem difficult to know strangers that morning. It didn't seem like much of a skill judging character. Mrs. Reisman was old enough to know that rain would fall again. She was talking to her son, asking him to picture with her the place in spring when the grass is blindingly green. She could imagine the tulips, the first chitter of robins, the leaves unfolding. The spring-fed pond violently appealed to her imagination. When we took the short walk down the lane and stood before the water, she grinned, that upper lip enlarging to grotesque proportions as it spread across her face. She could see the naked scouts running the length of the wooden pier and jumping, arms outstretched, into the clear water. "It is a shame," she said with her patrician, sharp diction, "that inner-city youth have to grow up surrounded by cement and broken glass. They don't know that they themselves are of the earth." The boys would study birds as well as microscopic organisms. They'd want to recycle and save the rainforests. The old farmhouse would be torn down, of course, and the barn could be turned into a lodge. They became slightly animated, thinking of the potential. Arnold nodded. Mrs. Reisman raised her eyebrows. He suggested they rent some of the fields to the neighboring farmers. "There won't be any for long," I might have said. Mrs. Reisman put her hand to her heart at the idea of the scouts earning merit badges for detasseling corn. Although suburban encroachment was fast upon us, to Sandy and even to Mrs. Reisman, our farm was deep country. For them it was plenty wild enough, and so close, only 70 minutes from Milwaukee. The girls staggered behind us as we walked the property. When Claire couldn't cope, I carried her on my shoulders. I held on to one of her legs, and with the other hand I dragged Emma along. She poked her fingernails into my palm, trying to hurt me. Arnold was a thin, clean-shaven man in his early 30s. He had taken over the family business, which I gathered meant managing the money. When we came to the old orchard, he took a deep breath and sat on a stump. He pulled each burr from his pant leg and flicked it away. Restored to his original state, he seemed at peace. Mrs. Reisman bent down and picked up a gnarled apple. "Isn't this a duchess?" she asked. Although I wasn't sure, I said that it was. "We had these at Maud's when I was little, Arnie," she called to him. The duchess apples were going to snag her in, just as the barn with the fresh white walls had caught me. Caucasian boys, Native American boys, Afro-American boys would come together to harvest the apples of her youth. Mrs. Reisman had an old-fashioned graciousness, as well as a detachment that befit her wealth. She would or would not have the property, and either way her life would go on exactly as it had before. She seemed not to enjoy shopping particularly, but she asked me questions about the farm. She did not have direct experience, but she was educated and knew what to ask. "How interesting," she responded without fail. Her great dignity, her code of behavior, neither required nor allowed her to ask me any personal questions. Sandy walked me to the front door after the other two were in the car. "She really likes it," she said in hushed conspiratorial tones. "She's a lady with a vision, that's for sure, and she's very impressed. She's the kind of person who feels a need to give back to her community. Her grandfather, I believe it was, founded one of the big Milwaukee breweries. Adele has always been so involved." The only thing that kept me from trusting Adele implicitly was the fact that she had Sandy in tow. "I've worked on a lot of different properties with her," Sandy went on, "and I can tell when she's affected positively." "I'm in a terrible hurry, Sandy, baby. I'm about to jump out of my skin. I know you didn't believe that shtick about my sister, so I leave it all to your imagination if you have one. I want cash now, sweetheart. That's the long and short of it." "People have been stopping at the sign," I lied. "A couple drove in last night and wanted to look around." "Really?" It was a statement of disbelief. I told him to call you, of course. I'm sure that on the way back to Milwaukee, Sandy, doing her utmost to represent me, explained to Mrs. Reisman that I was having personal problems and was looking forward to selling my property, that I had, in fact, an urgent need to make a major life change, and that considering my desperate need, I might be willing to part with the land at a radically lower price. Not many people in their right minds, after all, would buy a place with a conservation easement. I don't know if Rafferty had some kind of sixth sense operating. The day after Sandy came to scout out the farm, he called me for a change. And he continued calling me several times that week, as if he knew he needed to be alert. He phoned with good news once about a witness he'd discovered that was going to blow up the prosecution. He asked me how I was doing, how I was managing with the farm and the girls, questions he had not asked me at the start when I could have used someone's concern. I gave him no clues. "We're going along," I said. "Waiting. We're waiting."
This ends Disc 9.